The History Show with Maz Duncan.
Good evening. On this week's programme, the quest for the Irish Celt.
Irish people in America were very interested in their Celtic roots in old Europe.
Mairead Carew on the archaeological investigation in the 1930s, which sought to determine the racial and cultural heritage of the Irish people. Also, when the Pope moved to France.
You have writers as illustrious and famous as Dante and Petrarch saying that Rome has been reduced to a deceased, stinking corpse.
We visit Avignon, where seven successive popes lived and governed in the 14th century, instead of their traditional home in Rome. Plus,
James Murphy, husband of Mary Crowley, and Dean Mahomet, husband of Jane Daly. Two men seemingly very fortunate in their choice of wives.
Roland Kelly with twin stories that demonstrate the invaluable role of a good partner in trying times. But we begin this evening with the Tolton Games. 100 years ago, in the summer of 1924, Ireland hosted this extraordinary sporting and cultural event, a gathering of athletes and artists from across the world. The event saw more than 5,000 competitors engage in an array of sporting and artistic endeavours. In terms of scale, it was bigger than that year's Paris Olympic Games, earning much acclaim in the international media. Indeed, the Tolton Games of 1924 were so successful that they were repeated in 1928 and 1932. To learn more about the Games, their rise and their eventual demise, Ian Kennelly went to Dublin's Collins Barracks, where he met with Dr. Siobhan Doyle, historian, author and curatorial researcher at the National Museum of Ireland.
So it's 1924, Ireland is just out of civil war. There's thousands of deaths, there's a loss of infrastructure, and we have the establishment of the new Irish Free State. Not a republic yet, but still the Irish Free State wanted to show how they can stand on their own feet on an international stage and to show that it's not only a newly founded free state, but it also has an ancient image, that it has its own customs, its traditions. And that's why they decided to revert back to the ancient origins of the Tolton Games.
The revival of the Tolton Games was, its organisers hoped, a signal to the international community of nations that the new free state had an ancient and unique culture, one that had survived centuries of colonisation. Siobhan explained to me the long history of their ancient inspiration, the original Tolton Games.
The ancient Tolton Games actually predate the ancient Olympics in Greece. It's always great to have that boast over the Greeks. But they took place every year up until 1169 AD, so just before the Norman invasion. And they took place in the townland of Tolton in County Meath. And the whole idea was that they were a celebration of Queen Tolta. Lots of different events like stone lifting, dancing and other shows of strength. Obviously, the documentation of them is limited, but from what historians can gather from what we have, that they were a huge success.
Yet, given the context of the time, with the state struggling to recover from the Civil War, there was opposition to the idea of the Tolton Games, or to the idea of the Tolton Games being held at this particular time, as Siobhan explains.
It wasn't all plain sailing for the organisers of the Tolton Games. So in 1924, we have Sinn Féin having a massive opposition to the staging of the Tolton Games. Why? It's because they didn't want the Irish diaspora overseas to come over and see Ireland not as united, not as a 32-county state. So they wanted people to not participate in the Games, not support the Games, don't attend, and they produced a lot of pamphlets to distribute around Ireland and in particular around Dublin City, where a lot of the events were taking place, that showed their opposition, and they encouraged other people to support them in their opposition to the Tolton Games.
That opposition failed. In fact, it failed spectacularly. The Games had wide public and media support and drew huge crowds amounting to hundreds of thousands of people. Those fans enjoyed a varied range of events.
At the time, the Olympics had art competitions. They had music competitions as well, so the Tolton Games did that too. What's interesting is that the sporting events were limited to athletes of amateur status only, but for art competitions, there was no such rule in force. So you had some of the most famous artists in Ireland at the time and still today competing in those competitions. So you have the likes of Harry Clark, Margaret Clark, Sean Keating, W.B. Yeats competing in the poetry competition. There were 32 categories in the art competition. So just even looking at the vast array of categories themselves gives us an idea into the massive scope of these games.
Apart from competing, many prominent artists offered their public support, especially John McCormack, who praised the inaugural games. As Siobhan explains, the internationally renowned tenor subsequently retained a connection to the Tailteann Games.
John McCormack was very supportive of the idea of the Tailteann Games. He also donated a silver cup in 1928 for the solo singing competition. And when you see the trophy, it's in our collection in the National Museum of Ireland. It's on display and it's quite large. You know, it's not your standard silver trophy. It's a very elaborate design. An interesting facet is that the John McCormack Cup, its design has been reinvented again in the GA's Tailteann Cup. So the cup that's presented to the winners of the Tier 2 Senior Football Championship competition is based on the cup that John McCormack donated for the 1928 Tailteann Games. My blue-eyed Macushla,
of course, apart from the artistic competitions, there were many sports events branching far beyond track and field.
An enormous amount of sports categories. There was yachting that took place in Dunleary. There was motor racing in the Phoenix Park that was attended by over 100,000 spectators. Categories like chess. There was airplane races. There was camogie, hurling. You know, there was almost something for everyone. Most of them took place around Dublin. Croke Park remained the focal point of the Tailteann Games. You had the opening ceremony there and most of the athletics taking place there. You also had a marathon, started in Navan and finished in Croke Park. Mallow hosted the horse racing competition, but most of it was confined to Dublin City.
While Croke Park was central to the Games, the state's limited finances meant that creative thinking was required to stage some of the major events, particularly the swimming competitions. As Siobhan explains, they were moved to Dublin Zoo.
Some of them took place in the hippopotamus pool because resources were limited. You need to make use of what you have. So that was certainly the case for the swimming competitions. There's some wonderful footage of the competitions, including those that took place in Dublin Zoo. British Pathé, their archive footage of some of the competitions taking place. So it's brilliant to have that as a resource.
However, amid this vast celebration of sporting competition, some sports were, as Siobhan explains, deemed unsuitable for inclusion.
The principle of the Tailteann Games were of international integration, yet there was a deliberate exclusion of cricket, of rugby and of soccer because they were considered to be games that were traditionally viewed as British pastimes, and the Irish Free State wanted to have a particular version or viewing of Irish identity through the Tailteann Games. So, and cricket, soccer and rugby just didn't fit that.
Fitting the general tenor and purpose of the Games, the organisers stipulated that competitors had to have an Irish heritage, but there were exceptions to that rule.
In order to take part in the Games, participants were supposed to be of Irish heritage or of Irish birth, and usually the entrants were from traditional areas of Irish emigration, so America, the UK and Australia. But there were some exceptions made to the rule that the participants were to be of Irish heritage and Irish birth. One of them was a man called Harold Osborne, who was a long jumper on Team USA. He had won an Olympic medal. He came over and competed and won. You have a man called Johnny Weissmuller, who was a swimmer, and he went on to have international fame in Hollywood films playing the role of Tarzan.
The inclusion of such illustrious international competitors greatly added to the appeal of the Games, as Siobhan explains. Their involvement was enabled by the decision to hold the Telton Games soon after the Olympic Games.
So in 1924, you have the Olympic Games in Paris, you have them in Amsterdam in 28, and in 1932, you have them in Los Angeles. It was fine for the first 2 years, the first two iterations in 1924 and 28, because Ireland was relatively close by to Paris and to Amsterdam, and some of the athletes dropped into the Telton Games while they were in the general European area. Unfortunately, that wasn't as convenient for Los Angeles.
By then, 1932, the Games were facing what proved to be insurmountable challenges. Siobhan describes the demise of the modern Telton Games.
From the start, it caused frictions between the organising committees and the government because it was an enormous expense. You know, you think about a place that's just coming out of civil war, that there's a lot of buildings and places and families destroyed, and then you see the Irish state supporting and financially investing in this massive mega event, which is a luxury. So there were frictions from the start. In 1932, the Olympic Games took place in Los Angeles. So a lot of the athletes that were competing in LA were on the long boat to LA that took days and days to get to and from there. So the international dimension that was present for the 1924 and the 28 Games was gone. You didn't have as much of the Irish diaspora coming over. You didn't have as many of the Olympic athletes competing. So it was essentially domestic athletes competing against each other. So that excitement was gone. The 1932 Telton Games also took place right after the Eucharistic Congress, which was another mega event. And I think by then the people of Dublin, the people of Ireland had had enough. They had mega event fatigue, and the initial excitement and buzz that came with the Telton Games was gone by 1932.
So ended the Telton Games, a remarkable feature of life in newly independent Ireland. One of the goals of their organisers was to provide the world and Irish people at home and abroad with a portrayal of a state that was proud of its ancient heritage and willing to step onto the international stage. Contemporary reports suggest that they achieved that goal, at least in 1924 and 1928, while also providing the Irish public with an ambitious, thrilling and often joyful spectacle.
That was Ian Kennedy reporting there. He was talking to Dr. Siobhan Doyle about the Telton Games, that immense sporting and cultural competition held in Ireland during the 1920s and 1930s. In 1932, a team of academics from Harvard University arrived in the what was known then as the Irish Free State to begin a major archaeological and anthropological investigation. Welcomed and supported by the government, the Harvard team had a remarkable objective. It sought to determine the racial and cultural heritage of the Irish people. The Harvard research project had many strands. It involved countrywide excavations and the examination of prehistoric skulls, along with the physical examinations of thousands of Irish people, measuring skulls, nose shape and grade of hair colour. Though the Harvard project proved to be hugely influential, it was a product of its time, a particularly dangerous time in European and world history. Underpinning the project were theories of eugenics that would subsequently be exposed as racist and pseudoscientific. I'm joined by Dr. Mairead Carew, archaeologist and author, whose book The Quest for the Irish Celt contextualises the extraordinary story of Harvard University's five-year mission to Ireland during the 1930s. Mairead, you're very welcome back to the History Show. Why did Harvard University choose Ireland for this research mission?
Well, first of all, in 1930, Owen McNeill did a tour of American universities, which included Harvard, in an effort to promote Celtic studies and also to attract funding for Celtic research in Ireland. Ernest A. Hooton, he was the manager of the survey. one of the reasons he gave for involving himself in it was that Celtic, you know, the Irish language, was an ancient Aryan language once spoken all over Europe. And also that the Celts were important to America, American Celtic heritage. And Irish people in America were very interested in their Celtic roots in old Europe, outside of Greece and Rome.
And Irish people in America, or Irish Americans in the 1930s, would have become far more prominent, and they would have certainly, they were further up the social scale than they would have been in the 1870s and 1880s, for example.
For example, Hugh O'Neill Henken, he was the director of the excavations. He was of Irish and German extraction, and his grandfather had emigrated to New York, and by 1931 he was a curator of European archaeology in the Peabody Museum at Harvard.
And also at around this time you would have had a change of government. The Cumann na Gael government in 1932 are out of office. De Valera and Fianna Fáil are now in power, and the government welcomes this Harvard team with open arms, doesn't it?
Well, De Valera took a keen interest in the excavations, and he insisted on having all the reports sent to him personally. And in 1934, then he set up the unemployment schemes for archaeological research in Ireland, and they complemented the work of the Harvard mission.
And is one of the objects of all of this to counter the kind of simian type stereotyping of the Irish that you had in American magazines like Harper's Monthly, for example, and British magazines like Punch, for example? Is that part of what we're talking about here? Is part of what's going on?
Yes, because they were very interested in the connections between the Celts and Northern Europe and the Aryans. And they wanted to establish their roots in old Europe. And actually, in 1939, in Life magazine, they interviewed Ernest A. Houghton. There is a piece about him there. And they said that no baboon-faced Irish men were found during the Harvard survey.
So they're looking to find the noble Celt, is that it?
Yes, they are. And they're trying to establish when the Celts came to Ireland, who were they? And who are their descendants in the modern population?
Now, of course, nowadays, if anybody came here talking using the word Aryan, we would get the heebie-jeebies and we'd run a mile for them. But this is the 1930s. So 32, Harvard team arrives, begins its research. What are the primary questions that they hope to answer? And how do they plan to go about finding those answers?
Well, the person that they were associated with in the National Museum was Adolf Marr. So he was very influential in choosing the sites, and he chose Cranog sites. And the reasons he chose Cranog sites were practical and they were political. For practical reasons, Cranog sites are dwellings in lakes and bogs, so there's very good preservative properties. So the likelihood is that you will recover thousands of artefacts. And then for political reasons, the Nazis were very interested in lake dwellings in Switzerland and all over Central Europe, because they believed they were the strongholds of the ancient Germanic peoples who were descended from the Aryans.
So therefore, they had at some point come to Ireland. You mentioned Adolf Marr, an excellent director of the National Museum, but also, unfortunately, a Nazi. We'll come back to Marr shortly. Managing the Harvard mission is the anthropologist you've already mentioned, Ernest Houghton. At the time, he was a renowned, he was an extremely influential figure in the US, but he was a proponent of eugenics. Tell us a little bit about Houghton and his eugenics theories.
Well, eugenics was coined in 1883, and it was the science of better breeding for human beings. And it was coined by Ernest Galton, a cousin of Charles Darwin. Now, Ernest A. Houghton, he was a physical anthropologist, and he said himself he wasn't interested in the Nazis because he believed that the unfit from every race should be exterminated and not just the Jewish people.
So, I mean, this is what eugenics essentially was all about. It was about good breeding or correct breeding. And, I mean, it was a very, very prescriptive series of notions or a very prescriptive philosophy, wasn't it?
Oh, yes, it was. And there was the idea of the noble Celt was sort of a long-headed Northern European white man.
Because Ernest Houghton certainly would not have been interested in seeing the kind of Irish Americans who were represented in Harper's Weekly as simian creatures. He would not have wanted them breeding, would he?
No, no. It was all about selective breeding.
Tell us a bit then about a little bit more about Adolf Marr, as I say, director of the National Museum, and apparently an excellent director of the National Museum, very, very good at his job. But unfortunately, he was also Ireland's leading Nazi, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was head of the Nazi Party in Ireland. He came to Ireland in 1927 to take up the position of Keeper of Irish Antiquities. And he was promoted to the position of Director in 1934 by De Valera. Now, technically, the government knew he was a Nazi in 1938. And Frederick Boland, who was from the Department of External Affairs, he described him as the most active and fanatical National Socialist in the German colony here. And Hitler conferred a professorship on him in 1938. And he left then in 1939. But the Americans were well aware that he was involved in Nazi activities because there's correspondence from some of the American archaeologists. For example, from Hallam Movius, who was excavating the Mesolithic sites in the north, he wrote to Marr and said, "Dear Adolf, is your arm tired after being in Nuremberg?"
Yeah, because given Houghton's interest in eugenics, given Hitler's interest in eugenics, you would assume that Houghton and Marr would be soulmates. They were anything but.
Yeah, well, Houghton was against Nazism because he thought it was ruining anthropological science. But at the same time, he was disciplined by the president of Harvard for his own inhuman teachings.
Now, his eugenicist ideas are put into practice by the Harvard mission. They seem to have spent a lot of time travelling around the country measuring skulls and facial features. Tell us a little bit about that, if you would.
Yeah, well, they actually went to all 32 counties of Ireland and they examined 12,000 people. And then when they recovered skulls from various sites such as Gallen Priory, they were shipped over to the Peabody Museum because Houghton ran a bone lab there and he had skulls from all over the world.
So they are measuring the skulls of living Irish people. With what end in view? To prove that our foreheads are not at an angle? Was that what they were about?
No, it was actually to do with immigration. There was harsh new immigration laws introduced in the 20s. And then there was a lot of anthropological surveys going on all over Europe and Britain. For example, they wanted to find out whether people would be suitable as immigrants. So they were eugenically inspected. And they carried out these surveys, for example, in Norway, Sweden, Denmark, Czechoslovakia, Poland, Germany, Italy, Great Britain, and Ireland.
And what facial characteristics would be required for you to be a suitable subject for immigration?
Just that it wouldn't look simian.
Right, so that you would have a flat forehead.
Yes.
A 90-degree forehead, basically.
Yeah.
Amongst other things. Now, apart from anthropology, if you can call it anthropology, I suppose it passed for anthropology at the time, the Harvard team did conduct some actual archaeology. As you say, they were particularly interested in fortified lake dwellings in Cranoaks, like the Cranoak of Lagore near Dunshaughlin in County Meath. And, you know, presumably from what you were saying, it was Marr who directed them towards those areas of archaeological interest.
Yeah, well, most of the funding, which came from a Rockefeller grant and also wealthy Irish Americans contributed to it, was spent on the Cranoaks, and thousands of artefacts were recovered. And also all these excavations were extremely significant because the Harvard team brought a new era of scientific archaeology to Ireland. And in terms of their technical expertise and the large scale of the excavations and the scientific reports attached to them, they were actually a resounding success, because those reports, all of them, are still consulted today. And some of the sites have been reassessed, such as Ballanderry 1 Cranog, Ballanderry 2 Cranog, and the Roman material from Lagor and Carrickmon Fort.
Now, the data is one thing, the conclusions entirely different. So, I mean, we can still consult the data that they accumulated. Would we necessarily come to the same conclusions now as they did in the 1930s?
Not necessarily, because of the terminology they use, particularly around Celtic, because as far as they were concerned, you had Celtic Christians and Christian Celts. And, you know, that would have been a preconceived idea about the identity of Irish people. But because they were meticulous in the recovery of their data, and it was all cutting edge at that time, it had a huge influence on subsequent archaeologists.
One surprising aspect of all of this is that this was not just some obscure research project. It received a lot of publicity in Ireland, but it also received a lot of publicity in the USA. It was seen as hugely important by the Irish state and also by Irish Americans, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was reported on repeatedly in the newspapers here in Ireland and in America, as you say. And here in Ireland, the person who was responsible for doing the press releases was Adolf Marr. So you would get a lot of headlines like Ancient Celtic Glory and so forth. And an archaeology exhibition was sent over to the Chicago World Fair with some of the items recovered from the Harvard Cranogs. For example, there was a Viking gaming board and there was a bronze lamp. And these were part of a wider exhibition of cultural items, like including facsimiles of the Book of Kells and paintings by Sean Keating and that type of material.
What is the legacy of the Harvard mission? Because they came to look for the noble Celt. They came to find the noble Celt. You would assume that something where the outcome was so predetermined that the research would be invalid or dubious at best.
Well, you could say that about the physical anthropology, because that was completely discredited after the Second World War. But because they brought very innovative scientific techniques to the practice of archaeology, and a lot of Irish people also became involved, say, in the unemployment schemes. Like, one notable person would be Sean P. O'Riordan, who carried out a similar, very extensive research project at Loch Gur. And he was a noted field worker, but he went on to be professor of Celtic archaeology in UCD in 1943. And he was considered a major figure in European archaeology. And of course, he trained also the next generation of archaeologists.
I was under the impression that there was quite a bit of evidence, or there were certainly quite a few theories, that we are the Irish, we are not Celts. So did the Harvard mission actually teach us anything much about the Celts, about who the Celts were and how Celtic the Irish are?
Well, I think it was in 2006 that Barry Raftery, who was the professor of Celtic archaeology, said there's simply no evidence for invasion of Celts. But in reality, his own father, who had been director of the National Museum, he said back in 1930s something similar. He didn't say it quite bluntly, but he already knew that back then.
Yeah, I'm sure De Valera wouldn't particularly want to hear that from the director of the National Museum in the 1930s, would he?
Well, the director of the National Museum in the 1930s, of course, was Adolf Marr, wouldn't be saying that. That was known in the 1930s. by other archaeologists, but
so,
it wasn't
so
something
basically
you could
we didn't
say.
Really learn much from the Harvard mission about whether we are Celts or whether we're not Celts.
No, and yet we learned a huge amount about our past, if you like, because it was very innovative. As I said, those reports are still used today.
Okay, so despite
So like you see, it's one thing to have the actual ideology and to be choosing sites because of your ideology, and it's another thing to recover the data in a meticulous way.
It's just that when you have a particular ideology, oftentimes when you are assembling data, you are ignoring certain types of data, but presumably if the data survives, including the data that you're ignoring, it still has a certain value.
Oh yeah, it does, because people can come back and they can establish the facts. Even if you have been sort of ignoring it a bit in your report, if you actually recover it correctly. And also the scientific reports at the time were cutting edge for the time.
Well, Mairead, thank you very much indeed for joining us on The History Show to talk about that remarkable project, the Harvard Archaeological Mission to Ireland, although there's a lot of anthropology, as you say, in there, as well as archaeology. And Mairead's 2018 book on the subject is called The Quest for the Irish Celt, and it's published by Irish Academic Press. After the break, we'll be looking back to the 14th century to find out why the Pope moved from Rome to Avignon in modern France. Stay with us. Welcome back. Did you know that the Pope wasn't always based in Rome? At one time in the 14th century, the pontiff lived and operated out of the south of France. Seven successive popes lived there, all of them French. It was called the Avignon Papacy. Colin Flynn visited the south of France and found out more.
Well, it's 3:20 and we are getting up and going to the first office inquire.
Is it difficult getting up at 3:30 every morning to pray?
Yes, certainly, yes. In the silence of the night, we can offer up our whole day, you know. There is no noise, you see, and we are not disturbed.
So in the still of the night, while others here in France are in bed, you are up and you are praying.
Because we pray for them.
When people think of the Pope and the head of the Catholic Church, they think of the Vatican in Rome. But hidden away here in the region of Lebrun in the southeast of France, there is an incredible piece of papal history and a group of Benedictine monks continuing a tradition from the 14th century. The Abbey of St. Madeleine is situated in a stunning location, surrounded by hills and valleys, around an hour from the city of Avignon. Father Pierre Bazile is one of the monks who has been living here, mainly in silence, for 45 years.
Well, it's a life of prayer, study, and work. For instance, we have about 5 hours per day with the chant and the readings of the Bible. In the world, you have a lot of noise, so it prevents you to think about the most important things of the life.
And the most important thing for the monks here is giving praise to God through prayer and work, which they do every day in their vineyard producing wine. This is what makes them special. They're producing a wine called Via Caritatis, which is Latin for through charity, on the site of the very first papal vineyard from the beginning of the 14th century. Gabriel Tesser works at the abbey and is showing me around.
At the moment, we're standing at the first papal vineyard planted in 1309 by Pope Clement V, the first pope of Avignon, who came here instead of Rome, decided to settle down in this very place and to plant here the first papal vineyard. It was a very difficult moment because it was war in Italy. So the Pope Clement V, who was French actually, and he was from Bordeaux, so he was loving good wines, and he decided to move to France in this place, in this area which belonged to the Pope.
And we can hear the bells of the new monastery in the distance now.
Yeah, exactly. And 600 years after the first papal vineyard, the Benedictine monks came back in the region, rebuilt a monastery called Saint Madeleine, and rebuilt the first papal vineyard.
So how did the Avignon papacy come about? Dr. Jessica Warmberg is a historian of the religious and political history of Europe.
The origins of the Avignon papacy, the papacy being in the south of France, are a clash, a power struggle between the papacy and worldly leaders, namely Philip IV of France. Philip IV was the king of France in the early 14th century. He was arrogant. He wanted power. Like many monarchs, he was trying to expand his reach and also centralize his power to build something like a nation state, the Kingdom of France. He was also in power at a time when the popes thought that they'd won the argument about who was really at the top of the power hierarchy. Look, at the end of the day, we are the ones that you must bow down to. You might be king, emperor over your own lands, but we're emperors of souls, if you will, over you. Many people said that Philip himself was so arrogant and so power hungry, he thought of himself as king, emperor, and pope.
King Philip was a formidable force and decreed that he was ultimately responsible for selecting French bishops and cardinals. But in Rome, Pope Boniface VIII, he asserted his authority was supreme and told the king to back off.
And when Boniface VIII tries to assert his power, sends him a papal bull, which says, listen, my son, if anybody doesn't listen to the Pope, they're not a member of the Catholic Church and they won't be saved from eternal damnation. Philip sends a delegation to Italy to find the Pope, to demand that he retract what he says. They hold the Pope hostage and he dies from his injuries a month later.
After being kidnapped for a short period by the king's men, Pope Boniface VIII died in 1303. Then a new pope was elected, Pope Benedict XI, but after only 8 months, he too mysteriously died. And without a leader, the papacy was plunged into chaos.
The situation in Rome was tumultuous in this period anyway. There were many families, in addition to the papacy, who are putting candidates on the papal throne as well, putting many men in red hats as well as cardinals, and constantly vying for power. With a vacuum, whenever the papal throne is empty, it was extremely dangerous in the papal capital in Rome. These families are clashing, these families are warring, and everybody wants a decided, unified candidate who will settle things in Rome.
King Philip saw this as an opportunity and persuaded the many French cardinals to elect a French pope. And so in 1305, Pope Clement V became the successor of St. Peter. And because of the instability in Rome, he decided to stay in France. And so his papal palace was built in Avignon, and his summer palace was to be situated in Le Bourru, where there was already a monastery of Benedictine monks. Father Pierre Bazille.
And so he came to our area, and in 1309, he started a vineyard in a place which was given to him by Benedictine monks, not very far from here, about, let's say, 7 miles away from here, in the place called Notre-Dame du Grosso.
And that was where they would build for him, or he would use their monastery as a papal palace, more or less.
Exactly, for his holidays. So he would come because it's cooler here than in Avignon. So in 1309, he started a vineyard there.
Wow, because a papal palace needs good papal wine flowing.
Well, it's true. You need good wine. In any case, monks have always made wine because we need wine for the celebration of Mass.
And it wasn't just Pope Clement V, the next six popes after him stayed in Avignon, causing much disgust back in Rome.
You have writers as illustrious and famous as Dante and Petrarch saying that Rome has been reduced to a deceased, stinking corpse, that Avignon is the whore of Babylon. What's fascinating is that the Avignon papacy shows how important the idea of Peter and Rome is to the papacy. The Pope is only the Pope because he's Bishop of Rome and because Jesus said to Peter, "You will be the head of my church on earth." If he's not in Rome, who is he? And what is Rome? How can Rome be without a Pope?
The papacy eventually moved back to the Eternal City with Pope Gregory XI in 1376. And today, 650 years later, these Benedictine monks continue that tradition, chanting and praying five times a day, and working in the vineyard, producing their wine via Caritatis.
My name is Brother Winemaker.
Brother Winemaker?
Yes, because on the monastery we glorify God, and our identity is not necessary for the people. We want that the people drinking this Caritatis wine could make an experience of something divine, something from heaven.
And on my final evening in the monastery, over an open fire, I get to try the papal wine with Father Basil.
It's said in the Bible, Vinum letificet cor hominis, we say in Latin. Wine makes the heart of man more joyful, isn't it?
Benedicamus Domini, Deo grazie.
And that was Colm Flynn reporting there from the south of France on the period when the papal capital moved from Rome to Avignon in the 14th century. And in that piece we heard from Jessica Warnberg. Her recently published book is called City of Echoes, A New History of Rome, Its Popes and Its People. And that has a whole chapter on the Avignon papacy. We'll be back after this short break. Roland Kelly has written a few history scripts for us this season, all curiously featuring pairs. The first was about two bishops, the next about two islands, and this week it's about two wives, Jane Daly and Mary Crowley. If you were going to run into trouble with your business, they were the ideal women to be married to, because that's what they did. They gave their husband's endeavours a leg up at a crucial time.
The day 14-year-old Jane Daly saw the young man come into her college in Cork, she can't have known how her life was going to change. And similarly, James Murphy was 14 when he heard that his father had died in Cork, and he can't have known how that would change his life. To Jane Daly first. She was in college in Cork when a young man from India walked in. He was there to improve his English, having just come from India with an Anglo-Irish officer in the British Army there. The young man's name was Dean Mahomet. The year was 1784. It's not recorded what Jane was studying in the college, but it is recorded that she and Dean ran away to get married. He was 27, she was 14. She was from a wealthy family, and she and Dean had a comfortable life in Cork. He published a book on his travels in India. Some sources claim that he never visited some of the places he wrote about, and that he lifted some of the text from other books. Nevertheless, his book is recorded as being the first published in English by an Indian. Jean and Dean had seven, possibly eight children. Then, when he was in his late 40s and she in her mid-30s, Jane and Dean moved to London, where they lived in a fashionable area and were at the upper echelons of British society. Dean and Jane opened a restaurant in 1810, the Hindustan Coffee House. It was London's first Indian restaurant and even did home deliveries. But the venture failed within a couple of years and the family slid down the social scale. Dean advertised himself as a valet or gentleman's butler. He and Jane then ended up in 1814 in Brighton, managing a bathhouse. But they were great self-publicists. They offered free massage and aromatherapy to people who hadn't been cured elsewhere. Dean wrote another book about the cures he'd administered, and they adorned the walls with crutches and other paraphernalia belonging to those he claimed to cure. Eventually, he and Jane opened their own Mohammed's Indian Bathhouse, and crucial to its success was that it included a women's bathhouse run by Jane. They called their massage shampooing, after the Hindi word for massage, shampi. Their customers were royalty and aristocracy, and Dean was appointed shampooing surgeon to the king. He was at this time in his 60s, Jane was in her 50s. The baths flourished for 20 years, and the Mohammeds were prominent figures in Brighton life, but eventually the business declined and the bathhouse was sold. They still operated Indian baths from their new, more modest home, but it was Jane who kept the business going. The idea of Mohammed's Indian baths was taken over by rivals and became Turkish baths, and shampooing came to just mean hair washing. Jane and Dean died within a year of each other in 1850 and 1851. He was 91, she was 78. 30 years later, another Cork person in our story, James Murphy, was born near Bandon. When he was a teenager, his father had died after a fall from a horse. James blamed himself for the fall, believing he should have checked the saddle girth strap. He was the cleverest child in the family and was sent to train to be a priest in Maynooth. He went on to teach and minister in the US, but was dismissed from one post for negligence and admonished by the bishop in another for unsatisfactory conduct. In 1909, he left the US for Europe, where he studied in Italy and Germany, and effectively dropped out of the priesthood. The next 20 years or so are a string of jobs involving James Murphy with the powerful and intellectual elite of Europe. He was a war reporter during the First World War and gave a lecture in Buckingham Palace. He interviewed Mussolini, Einstein, Max Planck and Sean O'Casey, among others. In the late 1920s, he met a Londoner, Mary Crowley, who helped him prepare lectures for a tour of the US he was going on. When he returned from that tour, James and Mary married. In the 1920s, he had worked as a propagandist for the Italians, but called Mussolini a buffoon. During the 1930s, he and Mary lived in Germany, where he worked for the Nazis. He held with some, but not all, of their ideas. He didn't believe in biological racism, but thought Jewish culture was flawed. He agreed with the Nazis that Jews had been economically dominant in the past, but he thought that anti-Semitism was temporary. One of Murphy's assistants described him as intellectually arrogant and naively deluded. The Nazis, however, thought him a true believer and asked him to translate Hitler's book, Mein Kampf, into English. Murphy had hated an earlier abridged translation and completed his more readable version in 1937. As a complete version of Mein Kampf, Murphy's gave a better insight into the more extreme aspects of Hitler's personality. But, having finished his translation, James Murphy fell out of favour with the Nazis. He was drinking heavily and loudly questioning Hitler's sanity. He and Jane had to flee Germany. They had a publisher in London ready to publish the English version of Mein Kampf, but James and Mary had to leave Germany without his copy of the transcript, Hitler having ordered that all copies be sequestered. So there they were in London in 1938 with a publishing deal and no transcript. They knew that James wasn't welcome back in Germany, so Mary decided to go. She said, "They won't notice me." When she got to Berlin, she went to meet a man she knew at the Ministry of Propaganda and asked him for a carbon copy of the transcript. It happened to be the day after Kristallnacht, the night of the burning of Jewish shops and synagogues. Her contact refused, saying he'd be put up against a wall and shot if he gave her the transcript. Mary then remembered that she'd given a handwritten draft of James's translation to a typist. She went and met this woman, the woman still had the draft, and gave it to Mary. Mary returned home, and the English version of Mein Kampf was published. It sold 200,000 copies before the printing plates were destroyed in a German bombing raid in 1942. However, because of a dispute with the publishers, James and Mary only received £400. James died in 1946, aged 66. Mary described him as a man of huge intellect and presence, full of dreams and optimism. Anyone who married him would be very selfish because he belonged to everyone. Mary herself died in 2003, aged 98. She'd been a widow for 57 years. James Murphy, husband of Mary Crowley, and Dean Mohammed, husband of Jane Daly. two men seemingly very fortunate in their choice of wives.
Ronan Kelly there with those twin stories that demonstrate the invaluable role of a good partner in trying times. That's all we've time for on this evening's programme, and indeed all we've time for on this series of The History Show. We'll be back in the autumn with another run of episodes. Details of all our items as well as podcasts are on our website, rte.ie/historyshow. My thanks tonight to Cara O'Hare on sound and our researcher Ian Kennelly. The History Show is a Pegasus production for RTE. For now, from me, Miles Dungan, and producer Lorcan Clancy, goodbye and thanks for listening.